I'm very happy now to welcome Anat Shankar Osorio. She is a strategic communications consultant. She's author of the book Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you have written and as you have talked about, our way as human beings in any language, English or otherwise, in any culture, is guided by the metaphors and thought constructions that we use to the point where it's accurate to say the sentence, I'll see it when I believe it.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah. So basically, the way that we take in and process information is naturally governed, one might say constrained, by our brains and the way that our brains work. And so what we know from years and years of study and testing is that most of thought is unconscious. So we can only know what we think that we think. We are not actually accurate reporters of where our judgments and perceptions come from. And one of the ways that we sort of package information together and make sense of it is through metaphor. And these aren't exactly sort of the tortured metaphors of English class. They're metaphors that are so commonplace they slip by undetected. So, you know, when someone says to you, oh, he gave me the cold shoulder, you don't reach out and touch that person and you're like, wait, their shoulder feels warm. It's not literal.
All of these things are, as you say, unconscious, but your work is to make us conscious of them.
Right. So like what any social scientist does, I look for patterns, right? That's all social science is. It's pattern recognition. And in my case, the data that I use is language. And what I'm looking for is patterns in that language. And so when I see, for example, a tendency to talk about inequality as horizontal distance, which you can hear most often in a word like gap, and you can hear it in a chasm or a divide or a canyon. The author Barbara Ehrenreich once wrote, it's reaching Grand Canyon-esque proportions, right? So you can do lots of metaphorical extension with this concept. But when you think about that metaphor and you think about what it implies to people, you know, what are things that we know about horizontal distances? Well, most often they're natural, right? They just come to be. They aren't sort of a deliberate construction. And so what does it suggest to people when we are trying to talk about inequality in this gap language? In fact, we know what it suggests because we've done experimental research and we've seen that when you talk to people about inequality as a gap, they tend to conclude that it's too bad for the poor people, but it's natural and it can't be deliberately acted upon. You contrast that with a different metaphor, the notion of inequality as a barrier, or the notion of an economy off kilter or out of whack as some sort of entity that has no internal balance. And you get a very, very different set of notions, both about what inequality is, how it affects people, and what ought to be done about it.
And so one of the basics of that is whether the economy, whether inequality, whether the phenomena of our lives are natural or man-made.
Yeah, I mean, we know that people seek what we call cognitive consistency. And so if there is a feeling that something is a product of nature, then it doesn't feel logical to ask to have it legislated upon. So just as I would sound like a crazy person if I asked for my state legislature, I happen to live in California, to pass a law that it be low tide at some given moment, you can't do that, right? And one would not ask for that law. One would be very silly to ask for that law. So if it feels like the economic events of our lives, if you will, the hoarding, the great hoarding of wealth among a very, very tiny fraction of our populace, and therefore the not at all coincidental lack of any kind of resources by the vast swath of our population, if that just feels like sort of an act of God, then you can't ask for legislators at whatever level to sort of make a rule about it. You sound crazy.
I wonder about that because there are so many examples in rhetoric and so many contrasting examples, like is inequality a barrier or is it a gap? And there's also the metaphor of high at low. Are you at the top of the income ladder? Are you at the top of the ladder, the bottom of the ladder? But I do wonder, I mean, we are primates, right? And primates tend to have hierarchies in which the people on the creatures on the top are not very nice to the creatures on the bottom a lot of the time, even though they're all one community.
Yeah, absolutely. We are primates, and some of this stuff is deeply, deeply embedded. And there's a lot of people who are doing really, really wonderful work. John Jost at NYU, for example, he's a social psychologist on sort of the psychological underpinnings of political ideology. But I guess what I would say in response to that is if you're going to go the route of thinking of us as primates, which is totally accurate, you have to remember the fact that we have now decided that the stuff of basic living, water, air to a certain extent in terms of the cleanliness of the air and therefore its breathability, food, shelter, we buy and sell that. So even within a primate society, if that's sort of the place that you want to kind of wrestle, none of the primates are attempting to actually cause the other primates to not have basic needs met. Like, we have commercialized the stuff of basic living, where now to be a human, you have to pay to exist. And so I think that this deification of the economy, which is something I talk about a lot in the book, where we have sort of come to regard the economy as some sort of all-seeing, all-knowing force, and it is not just normal, but sort of logical and accepted that we expect politicians to get on our TVs and say, we can't do that, it'll hurt the economy, we can't do that, the markets will suffer, and we all sort of nod our heads and are like, oh, I guess we can't do this thing that would support basic human welfare. I don't think any primate in the right mind. I don't think, alpha gorilla or alpha chimp or alpha bonobo is trying to, yeah, he's beating up on the one who's moving up, but he's not trying to deny the sort of little ones food.
Well, also in that metaphor is the idea that the economy is itself an organism that will hurt or become healthy or be robust or be suffering, as opposed to a set of policies that have been legislated often by people who gain advantage by writing the rules to benefit themselves.
Precisely. And what it suggests at some level is that, this is the way that things have to be. And yes, they might be terrible for you right now, but it's almost biblical, or it's almost sort of very, very old school Christian theology where the meek shall inherit, right? And it's too bad that your life sucks right now, but you're going to get your reward in heaven. And it's not at all accidental or arbitrary that when we get into the economic space, we hear about discourse like sacrifice. The people need to sacrifice. That is part and parcel of the austerity doctrine. There's an article in Salon from Josh Idelson, and he's interviewing Alan Simpson, and he says to him, I think brilliantly, he says, tell me why people in my generation should care more about the deficit than they do about the fact that they don't have enough money to pay for their basic needs and the climate is, about to destroy us. Like, why should I care more about this kind of arbitrarily constructed conceit? I mean, let's recall that money is a fiction. Let's recall that money is a thing that we invent in order to facilitate, so that I don't have to drag you a cow every time that I want a ear of corn or whatever it is, because, that's goofy. And plus, you and I, we don't produce a tangible thing. And so we have decided we would denominate our efforts in this thing we call money. But it's all an invention. It's an invention that humans have made. Or, as I sometimes like to tell my clients, there's no such thing as systems. There are people making decisions, and those people have addresses.
Right. Well, and it leads to another whole question about money is the metaphor of making money.
Yes. Yeah. So this notion that some class of people in particular actually somehow produce value, when in fact we know that for the most part, not entirely, of course, capital has its place to play, incredible ideas have their place to play, of course. I'm a small business owner, I understand this. But the reason that there is money to pay people is because of the work that they do. And so when we have language on the left, I spend most of my time critiquing the left. I don't have energy left over to critique the right. As far as I'm concerned, their rhetoric is in complete alignment with what they seek to accomplish. And so
Wait, whose rhetoric is in alignment?
the right, promoting the notion of the economy as this sort of all-seeing, all-knowing, perfectly self-governing entity, is 100% in alignment with a free market ideology and a laissez-faire, don't interrupt, don't interfere.
It's funny because it's both a god and a force of nature,
Right.
a kind of Darwinian force of nature.
Yeah. And, we have a lot of facility as sort of speakers of English in our case, but in any language, of kind of toggling between metaphors. That's a very natural and easy thing for people to do. So it's not surprising to see sort of multiple ways of understanding it, even within the same sentence. That's totally normal for any kind of abstraction.
So back to the question of making money.
Yeah, so when you look at the language of the minimum wage debate that's going on right now in this country, and God bless the hardworking folks within the organized labor movement, within the worker center movement, with Fast Food Forward and the Fight for 15, incredible, the Our Walmart campaign, wonderful. But you think about the basic language of our demands, and they're generally things like workers deserve a raise. Right? Or workers should be paid more, or my absolute favorite phrase to pick on, hard work should be rewarded. Hard work, the reason there's money to pay people is because of the work that they do. A wage is not a reward. It's not like, oh, I accidentally found my paycheck on the street. Like,
Right.
how fortuitous. Before the moment that you actually inputted the labor, there wasn't the money to pay you. And in fact, the way that our system is set up, every worker in this country is giving a zero interest, generally 2 weeks, sometimes 1 month long loan to their employer because the money is generated at the point of work and then you're waiting to get it back. And so the question is not, the demand is not, workers deserve a raise or hard work should be rewarded. It's not give us a thing. It's return more of what we created in the first place.
Right, which I have to say, I mean, when you talk about where value is generated, not to get too Marxist about it, but laborers produce value
Right.
and then people at the top skim off enough of it to produce capital, and in theory, it all goes around, but in practice today in this country, it doesn't.
Right. And if you think about it at a fundamental sense, in order for somebody to extract additional value from an hour of labor, that means somebody has to get paid less than the value of that labor.
And it's the minimum wage workers.
And it is the minimum wage workers. And so the question becomes not, why is the wage this much and give us more? Which really sounds no different than my 7-year-old begging me for additional Lego sets. In my household, I'm the arbiter of how many Lego sets are purchased per month because he contributes nothing economically to my household. That is not the relationship between the worker and the employer. The worker generates the money that is there to pay him or her. And in fact, generates more than what he or she is paid. And so the question that we need to be asking in this country is what is what I like to call the RO, the return on work, which would be similar to the concept of ROI, return on investment. For the amount of money that I generate into this company as a worker, because of my productivity, and we know that productivity in this country has been phenomenal and has been skyrocketing over the last 50 years, and wages have not budged. So why is it that I produce more money into this company per hour of my labor every single day, every single month, every single year, but I don't see more of it? Where is that going? How much is that percentage? And let's have a debate. Let's have a realistic debate about not the minimum wage, but let's have a debate about how much of what a worker produces does that worker get paid?
And where is the rest of it going? And what is the language that those people who are taking it are using? Because a lot of that language is, oh, the people at the top, they're earning money, they're making money.
Right. They cause the money to come into existence, and so they have a rightful claim to it, in the way that I have a rightful claim to decide not to buy my son a Lego set. Because in that situation, that's actually the truth. That's how it works in my household. But that situation is not true in the labor market. And that's just basic capitalism, right? You don't hire somebody for $10 an hour unless you can make $10.01 off their labor. Otherwise, you don't know what you're doing.
What about alternative metaphors? I mean, the metaphor of the economy rather than being a kind of organism or a force of nature or a deity, the economy as agriculture.
Right. So that is a metaphor that's present in language. One of the things that I should back up and say is that we can't invent a metaphor for people from scratch. If I were to talk to you about the ingredients of a tasty economy, you would not know what I was talking about because that is not sort of a way we have of talking about the economy. So my arguments from that place wouldn't really make any sense to you. So we need to be looking at the range of metaphors that actually exist in the shared language community that we're trying to move policy in. And the notion of the economy as some sort of agricultural endeavor. So we talk about sowing the seeds of a sustainable prosperity, and we talk in the green sector movement, we talk about the green shoots of prosperity, right? So that does convey to people that there is some sort of deliberate, conscious decision making, because we're not talking about wildflowers on the side of the road. We're talking about crops that, you have to pay attention to, and you have to decide when to plant, and you have to decide how to plant, and you have to sort of deliberately cultivate, right? And so this is the notion that we have to sort of cultivate certain industries, we have to sort of deal with things that happen. The thing that's compelling to me about the agriculture metaphor is that when something happens to, a vast swath of land, we understand that we need to go and investigate and, is it the water? Is it the fertilizer? Is it the soil? Like, what is going on here? And in the United States, there, if you think about the kind of language that FDR was using, where he literally said, things are really bad and we're going to have to run a bunch of experiments. We're going to have to try this and we're going to have to try that, and some of it will work and some of it won't. The idea that a politician today would say anything close to that, I mean, he would be, and I say he deliberately because statistics are on the side of he, would be laughed off of every stage in America. But I mean, that is the truth of the matter. We need to be more creative and we need to be more experimental. There are certain things that we know. We know that you do not starve and impoverish people into prosperity. That's just logic.
Right. And also, I mean, in the austerity debate, to the extent that it is a debate, we never ask for austerity from the people who have the most, which is a huge, gigantic missing part. I mean, we've all, probably many of us, have seen those like maps of the United States. If the United States were wealth, the 1% owns like the entire East Coast, and the bottom 50% are living like in Houston or something like that. I mean, it's the inequality is so vast, and yet we're asking the poorest people to, or the poorest people being 50 to 75%, to take the burden of austerity.
Well, it's also because, in addition to the naturalistic metaphors that we talked about, there's a second sort of very strong strain within economic discourse, and it's used to great effect on the right, and it's unfortunately parroted to our peril on the left, which is the notion that the purpose of the economy, the reason that it exists, is in order to reward the good and punish the bad.
Which gets into a whole moral discourse.
Right. And so if you believe unconsciously that rich people are rich because God loves them better, which is, there's a sub doctrine of Christianity, and it's embarrassing to most real Christians, so I do need to say that. That's the prosperity gospel, the name it, claim it version of Christianity, where the having of a lot of stuff is a signal that God loves you better. And so it's this, perfectly encapsulated paradigm that is impenetrable, where you are rich because God loves you more, and God loves you more because you are rich. And sort of, there's nothing to do about that, right? If you're not in that box, like, there's no getting into that box. And so we don't ask the wealthy to do much of anything at all because, in this framework, they are morally superior. And again, getting back to the metaphor, when we talk about the top, in English, we have a very, very strong metaphor that good is up. And that's why we say things are looking up. And conversely, we call a prolonged period of sadness a depression. And we say he was down in the dumps, right? And so, because we have this notion that good is up,
And we elect the taller candidate for president.
absolutely, we actually, anytime we're referencing the wealthiest as the top and those with the least as the bottom, we are actually reinforcing this notion that they're not just worth more. but they are worth more.
It's funny because I mean, there are a lot of conflicting metaphors and conflicting strains of thought in the United States because we also elevate, there goes a hype metaphor, the working man, and that's really the salt of the earth kind of person. And we have a lot of images of the kind of evil, greedy capitalist.
Right. Yeah, and believing multiple even contradictory things at the same moment is sort of a hallmark of of people, not just Americans. I mean, we might arguably be especially adept at that, but that's sort of nothing new. But partly what that is sort of an escape valve. It's a, you can only make people so upset and angry. You can only extract so much from them and make their lives so impossible and confine them to a life of debt servitude, whether it be via student loans. I mean, let's think about the fact that our government, by which I mean us, because we're supposedly a democracy, lends money to banks who are among the wealthiest institutions in our nation at a rate that is, 400% lower than we lent money to our students,
Right.
to our youth. So what we are saying is, we're going to lend money to institutions who solely engage themselves. I mean, they used to engage themselves with being a place where people who wanted to invest and people who wanted to save could sort of trade so that we could have noble, forward-looking new enterprises. That's very, very small part of what they do now. Most of what they do is speculation. So we say as a nation via our government that it is a greater priority for us to give money to institutions that make up stuff, that get more money for inventing stuff, than it is to give it to 18-year-olds, to the future of our nation, to study more so that they can become doctors and engineers and lawyers and, teachers and the whole gamut. I mean, what, how far off have we gotten from any semblance of what counts and what matters? And that's not left or right, that's just right and wrong.
It's interesting too because there is such a mistrust of government which is heavily cultivated by the conservative right, and the idea of good government and the metaphors around and the images around good government, of by and for the people and all of that are few and far between.
Yeah, no, government has definitely become so reviled that it is, in fact, it is the caricature. And, that's one of the great achievements of the right, if you can call it an achievement, is to actually revile government and impugn government to such a great degree that you actually affect sort of who wants to go into government, who wants to serve there. And then you add into that a campaign financing scheme where basically it's only the top, oh, 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 look at me saying top. It's only the wealthiest 0.00001% that can even get themselves into higher office because you have to basically purchase yourself a seat, or you have to get your buddy at Monsanto to buy you one, then in effect, they say that government is awful and they made government awful while being in government. It's amazing.
And the advantage to that group of people, the advantage of making government awful, is laissez-faire capitalism.
It's laissez-faire capitalism, and it's a complete and total distrust of public institutions. So now, if you live in a state with a, subpar educational system, which frankly at this point is lots of them, then you're thinking, okay, well, there's the public school, which I don't trust and I don't like and is delivering bad outcomes. And there's the public park, which is dirty and never open, and the slide is broken. And there's the public library, which is open 1 hour a week, right? So it
Not in
looks.
Santa Fe, but we have great public libraries, but
We
anyway.
do too. I'm exaggerating. But, so there are these public institutions which, through a deliberate sort of campaign to defund them over years and years and years, have become less desirable. And so, as an individual, you're thinking, okay, well, I don't really like these public institutions because they're not good. And so I need to keep every single one of my dollars because I'm going to have to pay for the private equivalent. I'm going to have to pay for private school. I'm going to have to pay for some sort of private recreation. And I'm going to have to pay, I'm going to have to buy books, or I'm going to have to sort of buy a community center time and buy sort of activities for my children that are not free because I can't just take them to story time. And so then suddenly there is a need for, there is either literally a need or there is a feeling of a need to maintain every single one of your dollars because you're going to have to pay for everything privately, which is grossly inefficient.
And also excludes the vast majority of people
right.
who, no matter what, will never be able to afford public school or private, I mean, private school or private recreation. And it also really gets away from the idea that what government is a mechanism for collecting taxes, pooling them, and using them for the common good.
Right. I mean, that's really all it is. And we know that when you put your money together, you get better stuff. I mean, it's really not more complicated than when a group of friends decides, hey, it's someone's birthday, let's go in and buy a gift together so that we don't each buy them a CD they'll never listen to. I realize nobody even buys CDs anymore, but so I'm dating myself. But you know, you can get a better thing if everyone puts in money into a group kitty.
Right. I mean, the neighborhood association putting together money to pave the road.
Right.
So there is, as part of the American moral code, this idea of self-reliance, and it's been very tough to crack, but part of the rhetoric around that is work hard and play by the rules. Bill Clinton, you've quoted in your book, is saying that. What's wrong with that?
So that's lovely. It's lovely to work hard and play by the rules if playing by the rules actually had any validity in our society, when in fact we know that the people who benefit from the rules, as you were saying, are the ones
who make the rules.
Or who make the rules are the ones who benefit from it. And so, you know, to admonish somebody to say, you know, you should play by the rules, when in fact the people at the very, very top, they write the rules in order to benefit themselves. And so, I mean, it's kind of, it's audacious to say that. And as far as working hard, Americans are some of, are among the hardest workers in the entire world. We have less paid time off than any industrial nation. We are the only OECD country, the only industrialized wealthy country in the world with no paid family leave and no mandated paid sick days. We are alone in that. So basically, stuff that Haiti and various very, very low income African countries have figured out, we have still not managed. We have not managed the notion that after you give birth to a child, you kind of sort of, I don't know, need some time to actually raise them. And yet we're supposedly the nation of family values. I would posit that if you want to have family values, you kind of have to value families.
What a thought. Now, the left, as you write about, has been really clueless about language. The conservative right has put a great deal of effort, time, money, thought into making language that appeals to people. And one of the effects of that is people who are writing speech for right-wing politicians will use the words you and I, and they'll connect to people. Whereas people on the left will use the passive voice and say, you know, problems have occurred, things like that. Why is the progressive left so deeply long-term clueless?
Yeah, there's multiple reasons. One of the reasons is they have more money than us. They have more money than us because they're corporate overlords that tell them what to do, give them money in order to actually engage in deliberate processes. I mean, it's funny, you know, they're supposed to be the anti-education, anti-intellectual, anti-science people. They have some of the greatest social scientists and, you know, they test everything and they test everything in really, really comprehensive and therefore expensive ways. I mean, it's expensive to run a sort of statistically significant test for everything that you want to say. And they do, they take it seriously. Whereas on our side, where, you know, we're supposed to be the great intellectuals, we tend to rely on sort of just what comes out of our mouths. So part of it is just that they have more money to spend. Part of it is that when you are selling a package of a steaming pile of absolute crap, You have to wrap it in some pretty nice paper, and that paper's got to be pretty thick so that the smell doesn't come through. And so when you are selling people the very destruction of their planet, you got to wrap that up. You got to have a lot of ribbons on that to make it sound good. When you are selling people the fact that no matter what they do, no matter what they do, they're always going to be broke and they won't be able to retire and they should just work more
And
and
that's
they
freedom.
and that's freedom. I mean, that's pretty impressive. You do have to give credit where due. And so you do have to spend time and attention on that. And so on the left, we believe that because we are on the side of the truth, because we are, and because we are on the side of actual morality and actually helping people and actually honoring each other and each one of us for who we are and allowing people and enabling people to pursue their own happiness, we think, well, you shouldn't have to message that. You shouldn't have to concentrate on that. And we, in fact, some of us look down on that effort and say, oh, that's just spin. That's just rhetoric. That's just, dumbing things,
Manipulation.
manipulation. Because if what we're trying to give to people is a better, happier, cleaner, freer, less toxic, less violent world, then why are you going to need to, that should speak for itself. But in fact, what we know, as I said at the outset, was that people are not actually creatures of reason. None of us are. And we are not actually persuaded by the facts before us if those facts contradict the preconceived set of ideas that we bring to understanding those facts. And so partly it's, as my predecessor and mentor George Lakoff, I think, rightly diagnosed, it's a very, very steep attachment to Enlightenment reasoning, where we just think the facts will set us free, and we have, a very, very strong notion that if we just tell people, if we just tell people, we just tell people what's going on. And, my response when I get that from clients, because I do, is, how's that been working for you?
Anat Shankar Osorio is a strategic communications consultant. She's author of the book Don't Buy It: The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.